This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. We're here to discuss the important events of this past week. We have our panel of trumpet writers here in the studio. We have Jeremiah Jacques.
Great to be here.
We have Andrew Miller.
Hello.
Via Skype from our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And via Skype from our office in Jerusalem, we have Brent Nachtigall.
Hello.
There are already quite a lot of interesting things happening around the world in the wake of the transition of power in America. In the first half of our program today, we're going to discuss some of the political and economic ramifications in Israel, in Europe, especially Germany and Britain, and in China. And then in the second half, we'll focus on some stories related more toward what's happening militarily in the world. But we're going to start by talking about what might happen to the Arab-Israeli peace process because of a Trump presidency. This question is not only one that they're asking in Israel and around the Middle East, they're also asking it in Europe. European leaders are looking at the possibility of America withdrawing from that process, and they're asking themselves what sort of responsibility this would place on Europe. It's a very important question when looked at from the standpoint of biblical prophecy. And for this story, we're going to turn to our man in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
Yeah, we've discussed already on this show how many are just, including us, don't really know which way Trump's going to go, whether he's going to try and push. He said that he might try and push for some type of agreement between the Palestinians and Israelis. He would love that. But then what the feeling on the ground is over here is that he is going to probably withdraw a little bit from putting too much pressure on Israel, the Israeli right to concede too many things to the Palestinians in negotiations. And the Israeli right believes that his non-involvement is going to be good for them because it'll give them more leeway in which to act without the pressure of America there. And this is kind of the situation that Europe finds itself in, or the belief that Europe has also, that a Trump presidency is going to force them, because he's not going to be so involved, to come up with their own independent policy regarding the Middle East as far as how they're going to, they would have to separate from the United States as far as goals go, or the way to achieve Middle Eastern peace between the Palestinians and the Israelis. And this is something that we, you know, while we've expected this to happen, Europe to be the driving force for Middle East peace, even though America has had it for so long, or had been the main mediator of that for so long, we didn't know how it was going to come about. And yet Europe is looking at Trump, and they're looking at the things he's saying about how we just need to take care of ourselves, put America's first, look after ourselves. He's more isolationist, they feel. So they're like, we have to come up with a plan now and start instigating it and moving our own plan forward as far as the Middle East goes.
What are some of the specific indications that we're getting from Israelis and Europeans that they're really looking at Donald Trump as being more detached from this process?
Well, I think mainly it's his global view, as far as he's seen how much the American population is sick of their involvement in the Middle East altogether, and he has responded to that, be it Syria, be it, you know, the relations with Saudi Arabia, Iran. There is some type of will to withdraw from that and just focus on the items at home. And as far as the Israeli situation goes, he has made a number of comments that seem to be pro-Israel. And the main thing that the Europeans are scared of is that Israel is going to feel like the lack of pressure from the United States gives them a green light to, you know, increase settlement building in the West Bank and things like that.
Europe is really looking at this from a standpoint of trying to head Israel off at the pass to check what they would view as a likely emboldened Israel.
Yeah, they exactly that. They feel like the Israeli right is rejoicing, the elite Israeli leadership is rejoicing because Trump won't be involved. They can do what they want. And then the Europeans are saying, well, not so fast. We are going to be the ones now that put the pressure on to ensure that you stick to the two-state solution. Trump has even said that he might go back on that. He's given indication that he might not push the two-state solution. And yet the Europeans are like, no, not so fast, Israel. This is something that we are very much interested in pushing and something that we will even create economic incentives, both positive and negative for Israelis if they decide that Israel is pursuing a too right-wing agenda. If they're not taking the peace process seriously, then Europe has said, at least the article that we've got here in the Trumpet Weekly discusses some of the plans of the European Foreign Affairs Minister, basically Federica Mogherini, her office is coming up with to try and induce Israel to stick with a two-state solution, both positive ones and also negative ones as well, punitive measures against the Israeli state if they don't keep up with the peace process.
Now, in recent years, and we could even say decades, Europe has steadily emerged as something of a consensus choice as an objective mediator with respect to the Arab-Israeli relationship. But there is a lot of reason why Israelis should be pretty concerned about turning things over to Europe, even though it appears that at least in many circles in Israel, there's a certain willingness to do that. But maybe you could just talk a bit about the indications that Europe's working against Israeli interests.
Yeah, well, you do have the boycott divestment situation where there's a lot of – even the French government this week decided that they were going to label goods coming out of the West Bank so that they would know – their citizens would know which Israeli companies apparently are hurting Palestinian interests by, using their land to develop Israeli goods. And we have seen marches against Israel, even in Britain, in France as well. So there are those signs, but there is also the French proposal that there was a Paris summit this year, and there's going to be another one soon, that where they've come out and said that, well, if Israel doesn't work to achieve a Palestinian state alongside them, we are going to unilaterally decide that that will be so. So the French have been the ones that are kind of leading this, it seems. But where it's got now is it's going straight through to the EU itself. It's not necessarily a country leading it. And if we look at Bible prophecy, and that's what guides our interest in this, we see in the end time the America, the United States, no longer being a real factor as far as inside the Israeli-Palestinian peace process and the brotherhood between Israel and America being broken. But then we see Europe filling in that void, becoming the main peacemaker, the main negotiator. The prophecy indicates that Israel might be actually willing to let them mediate it at that point. Maybe the situation has gotten so bad within Israel that they are like, fine, okay, you guys can come and do it because we're at a loss right now to figure it out ourselves. So prophecy's indicated that it's going to go that way, and maybe we're seeing this that changeover, the changing of the guard for Middle Eastern peace take place right now.
It certainly seems that it could happen. You could definitely see a Trump presidency withdrawing to the point where Europe would step in and present itself as really the primary mediator in that process. And it wouldn't be difficult to see how quickly a Europe-mediated process could turn in a way that Israel would really be forced into even fewer options than it has now, and take the kind of radical measures that are indicated in prophecy. I would suggest that readers go and or listeners go to thetrumpet.com and to our booklet, Jerusalem in Prophecy, that explains how all of this is prophesied to unfold in the time ahead, and definitely something that we need to keep our eyes on, the American policy toward Israel in the coming months. Imagine that it's going to be fairly clear fairly soon just what direction that might break and how that might accelerate the fulfillment of some of those biblical prophecies. Thank you, Brent. We are going to look specifically now at Germany, an interesting political announcement this week. And what is really telling about it is the response that it is generating among Germans. For this story, we're going to go to our man in Britain, Richard Palmer.
Yes, last Sunday, just as we as it was rumored, German Chancellor Angela Merkel announced that she was going to stand for Chancellor as the leader of the Christian Democratic Union in the elections next autumn. So this will be it would be for her fourth term. Everyone was expecting her to run. She has, I think, a lot of support. Her approval ratings are fairly high. But like you indicated there, the announcement wasn't really met with any kind of enthusiasm. There was a big meh from the German press and political establishment and people, really. One of the Spiegel's commentators wrote, "Did anyone understand why Angela Merkel wants to run again, what she wants to do in the next 4 years in office?" He said, we can expect Merkel to simply plod on, and that can't be the whole solution. Horst Seehofer, who is the leader of the Angela Merkel's sister party, the CSU, and therefore in theory, you know, right, but like one of her political supporters and allies, he merely said, "It is good that we now have clarity." Hardly a ringing endorsement. And even another member of that party, Markus Söder, he said, "We should note Angela Merkel's announcement with respect, if not exactly with euphoria." And then, you know, we had quotes from the media that were very similar. You know, she's past her zenith. Die Welt, their headline kind of summed it all up. Merkel will do it. Who else? And that's kind of the real thinking is, well, there isn't anybody else, so it's got to be Merkel. And even Die Welt, they said, well, her first task has got to be to train a successor. So it's expected. Her approval ratings are fairly high, but nobody's just really fired up and excited about another Merkel candidacy.
How much has the problems that we've been talking about, economic and particularly the immigration crisis, we've been kind of writing her epitaph for quite a while now. It seems like she just has a certain, she provides this stability that Germans, they do seem to appreciate it. At least she's managed to survive a lot of those, the fallout from those things.
Yes, that's right. And I think you put the nail on the head with the stability, because what seems to happen to her approval rating is you get things like the migrant crisis and the immigrants going down, and the approval rating takes a big hit. But then something happens, like Donald Trump getting elected or the terrorist attacks in Paris, and then her approval rating shoots right back up again. Even though something like the terrorist attack in Paris would tie in, you'd have thought, with the migrant crisis. But she is Miss Stability. She's a safe pair of hands. The Germans trust, you know, her nickname is Mutti. And so as soon as you get these big shocks, it seems like people like the comfort of that stable leader. So her approval ratings have gone up and down in that pattern fairly consistently over the last year.
But this does still underline this general sense within Germany that, boy, it really would be nice if we had something more exciting to galvanize the nation in these times of crisis, as much as the kind of stability that you're talking about, as nice as that may be, it seems like we need leadership that really is commensurate with the times.
Oh, absolutely. And if you look at the way Angela Merkel deals with the problems, you know, they're not solved. I saw one article talking about, you know, saying basically, why is everyone cheering about Angela Merkel? She's just kicked the can down the road repeatedly with the euro crisis. Stratfor has an article that we quoted a section from that talks about all of these several potential crises that are up ahead with the euro crisis. And I think as it becomes more and more obvious that she's not actually solving problems, she's just kind of putting sticker plasters on and soldiering on and just kind of, you know, she keeps calm and carries on without actually fixing anything. And I think as that becomes more obvious, that will wane. And then I think I thought German foreign policy, they had a really good article that we've got some excerpts in the Trumpet Weekly. And actually, I sent this out to all of my IR students to read before next class, because we're talking about nationalism right now in that subject. And it talks about how one of the major challenges Miss Merkel has to face now is German nationalism. They said, you know, the next leader of Germany will face German, will, will do in the face of German nationalism, whether that leader will be able to control it or be controlled by it. And they compared Angela Merkel to Paul von Hindenburg, who was the leader of Germany that really had to try and hold the forces against nationalism before Hitler rose to power. And so to have a leader that's not necessarily liked, is kind of viewed as a pragmatist, but dealing with this very powerful force now of German nationalism, that's going to be a really interesting dynamic to watch as we come up to the election and perhaps even beyond that.
Something to watch for. We appreciate that, Richard. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. In Britain, we've had another interesting development, political development of sorts, an old face stepping back into the spotlight, apparently to try to provide an alternative to the populist Brexit movement and also the more far-left policies of today's Labour Party. For this story, we're going to turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, so actually, both the United States and the United Kingdom are experiencing levels of political division and gridlock not seen in decades. In Britain, obviously, the more obvious division is the referendum over Brexit, with 52% voting to leave the European Union and 48% voting to stay in. Now, like I said, we do have an old face, former Prime Minister and Labour Party Prime Minister Tony Blair, who is coming back in. He gave an interview with the New Statesman saying he wants to be back involved into politics, not to run for office necessarily, but to get back involved into politics to, I guess, quote unquote, provide a home for the politically homeless. And he's not actually talking about the actual homeless, but he's saying that. I was like, okay, well, if you've got 52% of the people who are looking to leave the European Union, of the 48% who are staying right now, kind of the only man speaking for them is Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party, who's a far-left socialist, even populist himself, even though Corbyn was for remaining in tentatively for remaining in the European Union. He is more of a kind of a Bernie Sanders-style rail against the big banks and the establishment type figure, very opposite to Mr. Blair's more close ties with big business and very close ties with the European Union. And so you are seeing kind of more of a three-way split between this more center-left internationalist movement represented by Tony Blair in Britain and the Clintons here in the United States, as opposed to the more far-left populist policies and then the, not Remain, but the Leave camp.
Richard, what does this tell us about British politics today? What does it tell us that we have this, say, division within the Labour Party and a voice as prominent as Tony Blair's stepping up and presenting himself as an alternative to what you're seeing elsewhere in British politics?
Yeah, I think it shows the inter-party division you have in a lot of politics. Even the Conservative Party, you have the pro-Brexit Conservatives and you have the pro-EU Conservatives, and there's always been a strong pro-EU wing. And then you see this in the Labour Party as well. And Jeremy Corbyn used to be pro getting Britain out of the EU. And there was a big attempt to get rid of him. If you remember, right after the Brexit vote, people wanted to replace him as Labour leader. They forced another leadership election because they were disappointed with his performance there. And now if you've got a former Labour leader, Tony Blair, who Jeremy Corbyn absolutely hates, who Jeremy Corbyn has spoken about in like wanting to jail for war crimes, who supporters will respond to with just absolutely violent emotions, if he's stepping up and taking a much bigger role now on the world, that's really going to just make that split in the Labour. It could really excavate that split in the Labour Party between the kind of disciples of Tony Blair and those that want to follow Corbyn.
Well, in a way, it seems kind of similar to what we've seen happening in the United States both political parties.
Right. It has always been a little surprising to me, even recently, just kind of how much similarities there are between the political currents in the United States and Britain right now, because now especially that the Hillary Clinton's lost the election and the Clintons were very close with Tony Blair in the 90s, She kind of represents this more internationalist wing of the Democratic Party. And so now there is almost kind of like a little miniaturized civil war within the Democratic Party as they're trying to figure out, it's like, okay, well, is Clinton's defeat a sign that we need to move more towards Bernie Sanders style populism, or do we need to rally back behind the internationalist policies of the 90s, or in which way do we want to go? And so you're seeing that that struggle with the left policy, the left party policies in both the United States and Britain, which is just really just leading really the fragmentation of the political landscape in a way we haven't seen in quite a long time, even within parties and definitely between the parties, just show that there's the national consensus about the way forward. It really is breaking down.
Thanks for that, Andrew. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. One more story before the break. This is an economic story about China. Donald Trump said that one thing he will do as president is quit the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Pact, the TPP. This is something that China is actually celebrating. For this story, we're going to go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, it was on Monday, Mr. Trump unveiled his plans for his first 100 days in office. And he actually said that on the very first day that he's in the White House, he will quit the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And many analysts in the U.S. and China and elsewhere are saying that the decision by America to pull out of the TPP would end up being a major victory for China and for China's expansionist ambitions in Asia. The TPP did have some problems and some pretty troubling aspects to it. This was the trade pact that the Obama administration had drawn up a couple of years ago and only unveiled and revealed to the world after it was sort of too late to be stopped, at least under his administration. And it was really the biggest global trade deal in about 20 years. It involved 12 different countries. And although it was marketed to the world as a free trade deal, its critics worried that it gave way too much power to big corporations, even allowing them to pressure their governments in confidential tribunals into sidestepping all kinds of laws about safety and labor and environment. And some estimates also said that the TPP would result in the loss of about 500,000 jobs in the United States. So you can see why Mr. Trump wanted to retreat from this massive deal. But the problem is that the TPP had another main goal, which was to counter China's increasing influence in Asia. The thinking was that if the U.S. could get more Asian nations to become more closely economically linked with America, then those nations would be doing less trade with China, they would be less susceptible to Chinese influence, and they would be more welcoming of America's foreign policy. And the deal was specifically designed to exclude China for that very reason. And China hated it. Just last weekend, the official Chinese news agency described the TPP as the economic arm of the Obama administration's geopolitical strategy to make sure that Washington rules supreme in Asia. So Mr. Trump's promise to pull out of it does make sense for America in some ways, but it did mark a significant victory for China. It means that America's Asian partners will basically consider America as an unreliable partner. They'll feel like America is subject to dramatic changes every 4 or 8 years, depending on how the election cycles go. And since the TPP nations were told that the trade deal was basically a means of boosting American leadership in Asia, they'll be left to conclude that the fact that America is now pulling out of it kind of signals the opposite, that America's leadership in Asia is being scaled down pretty dramatically. And so China's going to be there eager to fill any leadership void left by this, whether it's a real or perceived void.
Well, it didn't seem to be slowing China down too much as it was. It's been really on a roll in terms of increasing its influence in the region anyway. If this accelerates that trend, it seems like China, there's very little standing in China's way.
Yeah, that's right. Well, the deal had not yet been implemented. It hadn't gone into effect, so it hadn't done anything to curtail China's rise. But I think it was supposed to have really gone into full force in early 2018 or thereabouts. And that's when the effects were supposed to set in. But yeah, the Chinese are just celebrating now, knowing that this pact that excluded them is no longer really on the table.
And these nations that were hoping for TPP to be put in place had somewhat of a thin reed of hope to hold on to in terms of a counterbalance to China. It seems like there are a number of them that are having to accommodate. We've talked quite a bit about the nations in the Asian region having to accommodate China's rise and to recognize that this is the way the direction of events is flowing, and they need to get on board with that new direction, this post-American world that we've talked so much about.
Yes, very true. And this also just exacerbates the general uncertainty about what Mr. Trump's victory will mean for his foreign policy in Asia and everywhere else in the world.
Well, thanks for that, Jeremiah. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, we're going to talk about military matters, Britain signaling its willingness to cooperate with Europe's military unification, some alarm bells sounding over the effectiveness of America's military, Iran continuing its activities in defiance of the nuclear deal and United Nations resolutions, and Japan using its military in a way that it hasn't done since World War II. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
We're going to get now into military matters. We've been talking about Europe's plans to move forward with creating a pan-European military. This week, Britain signaled that after having been against this project for so long, and even having voted this past summer to leave the European Union, probably over this and other matters, that it might actually be willing to lend support to this project. For this, we're going to go back to Britain and hear from Richard Palmer.
Yes, the thinking in Britain seems to be that we're not going to be able to block this thing in the long term. If we do, it's only going to create a lot of goodwill, so we might as well just get out of everybody's way, let Europe create the military, and even perhaps work with it on some occasions. Britain's foreign secretary, Boris Johnson, he said that if our friends want to go ahead with a new security architecture, I don't think post-Brexit we can reasonably stand in their way. What we might suggest is that given we are the biggest military power in the area, the only other nuclear power, it wouldn't be a bad idea, if they do genuinely go ahead with such a thing, to consider a way in which Britain could be supportive involved in the enterprise. And then The Guardian also reported that apparently a lot of people at in the government, top officials, are thinking that, well, if Britain makes some offers to cooperate on defense and on foreign policy, then that make, the way they put it, oil the wheels in the more difficult negotiations over access to the single market. So basically, Britain might help out on some of the military areas in exchange for economic benefits and access to the single market and a bit more flexibility in terms of trade.
It's an interesting dynamic because this really seems like this was in part what those who were against Brexit were arguing, that once Britain put itself outside of that union, that it would have less leverage in dealing with these kinds of matters, that Europe would be able to act more on its own. And now Britain seems like it's being put in a position where it's having to accommodate Europe's desires in this respect without Britain being a part of it.
Yes, I think both sides in the Brexit debate seem like they generally took it for granted that the EU was a decaying, if not dying, institution. You know, those who wanted to stay in kind of said, well, the EU has gone as unified as it's going to be. And those that wanted to go out kind of talked about it being dead, and it's just a case of getting ourselves away from a corpse. So I think both sides have underestimated the potential here. They probably both do still underestimate the potential threat that a united European military power would pose to Britain, which is probably why they're being willing to cooperate on it.
Well, what might Britain's participation in this way mean for Europe? Having been Britain had been the albatross around its neck for so long and prevented this from moving forward. Now that Britain is not part of these negotiations directly, it's moving forward with it, but it Britain is actually saying, well, we might be able to help with some of these logistical matters. How much of a difference might this make for Europe?
I think the biggest thing is Britain getting out of the way. Because, of course, Britain is still technically a member of the European Union right now, and they're likely to remain so for at least 2 years. And so for that time, they could still slow things down. I think there are ways that Europe could get around British veto with things like permanent structured cooperation that we spoke about last time, where a few groups go ahead with the European military. But they could still be there constantly slowing things down, referring things to the European Court of Justice, you know, putting in procedural things to delay. So I think the lack of Britain delaying and just getting out of the way would be the biggest effect. But then the rest, I think, just depends on how far Britain would be prepared to go. Of course, Britain is the one of only two nuclear powers in the continent, apart from American nuclear weapons that are stationed across Europe. It is eventually going to be one of only two nations in Europe with aircraft carriers. So it does have some capacities that Europe is short on, and it would be willing to help. And of course, British military is very, very strongly reliant on French. There was an Anglo-British defense treaty signed a few years ago. Britain cannot really defend itself without French help anymore. So even if Britain leaves the European Union because of that defense treaty, it's still going to be very closely enmeshed with European defenses. And knowing what we know about Bible prophecy, about Britain looking to Europe, looking for Germany to its defense, and who knows, maybe it will give or lend a significant portion of its military hardware over to Europe, especially as I talked about on Trumpet Daily Radio, they're going without missiles on their ships in order to save money. If Britain's that desperate to cut costs in its military, what other major risks would it be willing to take? I mean, in some ways, you could see them saying, well, having a useless navy, at least working with Europe, allows us to have, say, missiles on our ships. That's better than having ships without missiles. Maybe we should go down that route. So you could see a Britain desperate to cut costs looking to that as an alternative rather than going along with the next to useless navy.
That really is a perfect transition to our next story. As Richard mentioned, he guest hosted this morning on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show and talked about the weakness of Britain's military and also the American military. I'd like to just move now into that second story about what's happening in America's military. And for this story, we're going to turn to Andrew Miller.
The Heritage Foundation just released its 2017 Index of U.S. Military Power, and its conclusions weren't very flattering. Overall, its general assessment of the United States Armed Forces is that their ability to handle combat operations were marginal, and that the U.S. Army in particular was weak. Now, this assessment basically comes on just like how effective are the existing battalions we have at completing the assignments, which would be might arise in a combat situation. And it found for the Army in particular that actually only about 1/3 of all the divisions in the U.S. Army are currently ready for combat should they be called upon. And then the assessment for like the Navy and the Marine Corps and the Air Force was a little better, but still the overall assessment even for them was that they're marginally prepared for combat operations.
So even though we have a whole lot of resources at our disposal, the question of which of those we could marshal and send into battle really is what they're looking at here.
Right. Usually when you see news agencies reporting on the strength of the U.S. military, they'll report on how much money we're spending on it, or they'll report on how many troops we have, or they'll report on how many divisions we have. But sometimes you have to dig a little deeper to actually see. It's like, okay, well, we do spend this much money on this many troops, but how many of those troops are actually ready for combat? And that's kind of the issue the Heritage Foundation was pointing out, because now, obviously, we're getting a new commander-in-chief here shortly. And he definitely has a lot of plans to make the American military great again. In particular, he's talking about recruiting up to 100,000 more soldiers for the Army, building dozens of new ships for the Navy, building dozens of new planes for the Air Force. But the concern that some military analysts have is that, okay, it's like, well, now we're spending more money and we have more ships and we have more planes, but none of that plan has addressed, at least so far, what about all these divisions and troops and ships we already have that aren't working or they're not combat ready? Because even some budget analysts they're saying that they're thinking the over the next 10 years that Trump's military spending plans may cost $500 billion. And so that is a lot of money, a lot of money that I guess, frankly, America does not have right now for military operations, when some are wondering if maybe it wouldn't be more concerned to look at how the money we're already spending is being used. Even though it's been required since 1995 to audit the Pentagon, they've been kicking that can down the road for the last couple decades. And there was even one report by the Defense Department Inspector General this June showing that currently they know of $6.5 trillion in military in past military spending that they don't actually have receipts for. No one knows what this $6.5 trillion was used for, or that's even where it came from. So yeah, that's like a third of the gross domestic product of the United States. And it doesn't, the report, I don't think it actually says exactly how, like I said, they don't know where it came from. So this could have been spent over many years, but it is a lot of money and just unaccounted for spending that there is some concern over. I mean, you always hear some reports, I don't know how widespread it is, of like $50 hammers being used by a military contractor for something like that.
But I would presume, though, that, say, those at the Heritage Foundation and elsewhere who would be concerned about the ineffectiveness of America's military and saying that, you know, we're not operating at near what people would think is our capacity, would be heartened by the introduction of a commander-in-chief who's at least proposing to move things in the opposite direction, even if the question remains open, how will he pay for these things? Still, he's clearly talking about moving it opposite.
Right, and I think the Heritage Foundation in particular probably seems pretty supportive of, even though their report didn't mention Donald Trump's particular plans, it was about the past, but their report was recommending they thought more spending was necessary. So I'm sure they're quite supportive of a commander-in-chief who realizes that our army is weak, trending towards marginal, and is looking at trying to reverse that trend and strengthen America's military abroad. It's probably more some other more libertarian organizations that are trying to sound the alarm on the threat of the debt level that's not turning around.
Right. Well, I guess we just wait and watch to see what happens here. Clearly, if the Heritage Report's foundation stands, it gives us an idea of the picture, the current picture, and then we'll just have to see how much of those promises end up being carried out. And of course, viewing all of this in its spiritual terms and looking at just how much trust the United States is investing in its military, it will be interesting to see where that goes in the time ahead under a new commander-in-chief. So we appreciate you bringing that story to us. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. We're going to return now to the Middle East. It seems Iran's transformation from pariah status into just one more nation to do business with continues to progress, but information keeps surfacing of just how all of the activities that earned Iran that status as a pariah, it just keeps doing those things. A report surfaced this week of its ongoing support for Hezbollah that should be of significant concern. For this story, we're going to go back to Jerusalem and Brent Noctegal.
Israel's ambassador to the United Nations, Danny Dannon, he penned a letter to the Security Council this week and informed them of Iran's blatant defiance of a number of different Security Council resolutions, in sending weaponry to Hezbollah. And the way that Iran's doing it is the interesting part. They're actually using commercial flights to send weapons. He said that the Iranian Al-Quds force, this is his letter now, the Iranian Al-Quds force packs weapons, ammunition, and missile technology to Hezbollah in suitcases and puts them on Ma'an air flights. So one of their carriers, it flies from Tehran, goes to Beirut, and Iran is using that commercial airliner to send weapons to Hezbollah. And Hezbollah isn't just a ragtag bunch of crazy guys, militia. They, as he even puts down in this letter, he says Hezbollah has more missiles below ground in Lebanon than European NATO allies have about above ground. They have over 100,000 missiles in southern Lebanon in bunkers already, just waiting to be used against Israel. And he is just trying to get them to see, yes, the nuclear deal has passed, but Iran hasn't changed one single bit.
Another extraordinary revelation in this, well, we have this in the Trumpet Weekly this week, regards even as activities like this are going on, and this is hardly an isolated incident. It seems like these kinds of things, last week we were talking about Yemen, we've been talking about other areas where Iran has been very active in ways that are completely contrary to American interests. And yet at the same time, the Obama administration is ready to strike a major deal with Iran.
Yeah, it's as we bring out there, this letter came the same week that the Obama administration okayed the sale of more than 100 Airbus planes to Iran. They haven't had new planes for about 30 years or so. And they've wanted, this is one of the first deals to be made, or first bits of interest post-nuclear deal, was the purchase of planes for Iran commercial airliners. And this week, as I said, there was 100 of those planes that were agreed upon by the Obama administration to be sold to Iran. They are Airbus planes, not Boeing planes. So it's not an American company, but 10% of the Airbus parts do come from the United States. So the U.S. government had to okay the deal. At the same time, there was a movement in the Republican-controlled House to try and stop this deal from going ahead. It passed through the House and it's got to pass the Senate. But then if it gets to Mr. Obama's desk before he is out of office, he'll probably veto it anyway. Now, it is worth noting that the sale of these were to a different airline than the airline that is right now that we know of that is participating in these weapon transfers from Iran to Lebanon and Hezbollah. But as we've seen, it doesn't really matter what the company is inside Iran. The Iranian leaders, especially the Quds force, are able to utilize all the tools that they have at their disposal.
Now, this letter from Israel to the Security Council also mentioned Iran using these commercial flights to transport weapons to Syria as well, correct?
Yeah, that's right. They are sending them to Damascus as well to help out the Syrian regime. And it is important to note that the transfer of weapons like this using commercial airliners is in direct contravention to a number of Security Council resolutions, especially the arming of Hezbollah as well. This is something that in 2006, when they passed this resolution, there was, you know, UNIFIL that were there on the southern border of Lebanon bordering Israel, and they were there to maintain the peace and to see that Hezbollah didn't rearm. And yet they are stocked to the teeth, 17 times more than they were back then in 2006. So the United Nations Security Council resolutions obviously been broken by Iran for decades now, and that doesn't seem to change no matter how much noise Israel tries to make about it.
It even directly violates the nuclear deal itself. This was sort of activity, at least that's what the Israeli ambassador is talking about, that this is directly against what the Security Council agreed to in the nuclear arrangement that went into effect in January.
Exactly, and that's what's interesting as well, because this contravenes that, and one of the first things that came down after January 16 was this pending sale as well of more armaments. The airline that is receiving the 100 new planes, they were taken off the blacklist, and now they are going to get going to get access? Why were they on the blacklist the first place? You have to ask that. And now they're just going to get more of the funding and more of the resources that they need to pursue really anti-Israel actions in the Middle East. And that's what we said it was going to happen. This was the problem with this $100 billion of unfrozen assets that was going to get given to Iran. What are they going to do with the money? Well, they're buying planes. They're buying 100 new jetliners. What are they already doing, the jetliners they have, and they have continued to do for the past 11 months? They've continued to arm their proxies across the Middle East.
Thank you, Brent. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. To Asia now, the moratorium that was placed on Japan's military after World War II has been gradually lifting in recent years. This week, another milestone in this process was reached. And for this story, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, listeners may remember one of our Trumpet Hour episodes back in September of 2015. And in that episode, we discussed how the Japanese parliament had erupted into a really rowdy melee, with some members piling on top of the committee chairman and yanking the microphone away from him. The reason for all that chaos and tension was because the chairman was just about to call for a vote that would allow Japan to take a major step toward becoming a full-fledged military power once again. The vote would pass some legislation that basically let Japan's military fight on foreign soil for the first time, like you said, since World War II. And after a few minutes, those in favor of voting on the measure were able to sort of prevail over those who were in favor of keeping Japan pacifistic. They returned the mic to the chairman. The committee voted on that measure, and it did pass. And that was a huge event. Passing that legislation meant that, at least in nominal terms, decades of Japanese pacifism had ended. But then we didn't really hear too much about that for, you know, the year or so since that happened. But on Monday of this week, after this was, you know, 14 months after that historic parliamentary session, Japan's first gun-carrying soldiers since the end of World War II were actually deployed overseas. This was 130 Japanese troops authorized to use force, and they landed in Juba, the capital of South Sudan. And by mid-December, their numbers will reach 350. South Sudan is in the middle of a really bloody civil war, and these Japanese troops are there as part of a UN peacekeeping mission. Their main task is to help build infrastructure in South Sudan. But because of the results of that September 2015 vote, these Japanese troops will have a mandate that none of their countrymen have had for some 70 years now. They are permitted to use force. They can use military force to protect UN staff, to protect Sudanese civilians, and to protect themselves. I've got a quote here about the specifics of this mandate. It says the Japanese are, quote, now permitted to fire warning shots to make an armed group back off, and they have an approval to fire directly at assailants if they determine themselves to be in life-threatening danger. And then there are also plans in the works to let these Japanese troops secure UN facilities, which have several times during this civil war, UN facilities have come under attack. And so it's likely that they will again. And now the Japanese will be able to, you know, protect the facilities if that happens. So at first glance, this might appear to be just part of a routine peacekeeping mission and actually good news for South Sudan, which really does need a lot of help right now to return to some level of stability after so many years of violent war. But since this is Japan, it's really more complex than that, and it's really a sobering development. Before and during World War II, the Japanese military was just fanatical and ruthless to a degree that shocked the world. And by the time that war ended, Japan had been fighting for 14 years, and almost 3 million Japanese were dead. Many more were starving and injured and seriously ill, and the nation lay in ruins. But even then, so much of that perverse military fanaticism still prevailed that it took those two atomic bombs to really bring a halt to that fanaticism and to Japan's fighting. And then, of course, it was in the immediate aftermath of that the United States occupied Japan and drafted its constitution. And under General Douglas MacArthur, the Americans really wanted to ensure that that kind of Japanese militarism and fanaticism could never rise back up again. So in the constitution that they drafted, they included that clause that outlawed war as a means for Japan to settle any international disputes. And so for 70 years, Japan has abided by that and has not deployed any troops abroad with any mandate to use force. But on Monday, with that small deployment, those 130 soldiers, all of that changed. So if you keep that World War II history in mind, then it's clear that this really is a pretty sobering development, and it just shows that Japan really is on its way toward becoming a full-fledged military power once again.
Any backlash?
Well, anytime Japan takes one of these steps toward sort of moving away from its pacifism, most of the backlash comes from the nations who suffered under it during, mostly in the lead up to and during World War II. So that's South Korea and China, the ones that were invaded and just brutalized in that invasion. So there has been several statements from Chinese and South Korean diplomats and others in the U.S. and the Philippines just saying this is something to keep an eye on. So there is certainly a lot of worry.
Well, we appreciate you bringing that to us. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. Go there to receive a free subscription to our weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. Every week we put this report together with all of the best, most important news from around the world, including all the stories that we've discussed on today's program and a whole lot more. We're going to finish the program with our lightning round of important news from all our panelists. That's coming up next.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
It's time now for our lightning round. We'll take one last look at some headlines that caught our attention this week, and we'll start with Jeremiah.
Russia said this week that it will deploy nuclear-capable missiles to the enclave of Kaliningrad. That's the Russian territory that borders both Lithuania and Poland. And Russia said it decided to deploy these missiles there in response to moves by NATO to increase its presence around Eastern Europe. So it's another escalation in the rising tensions that we see between Europe and Russia. And it's clear that Russia's increasingly assertive posturing there in Kaliningrad and elsewhere is really frightening Europe, and it is contributing to EU unification and militarization.
All right, we'll go now to Brent.
Israeli firefighters on Friday reined in a blaze that had spread across the country's third largest city of Haifa. Yesterday, some 60,000 people were evacuated, which the mayor called the largest mass civilian mobilization in Israel's history. Some 600 apartments were charred by the blaze, and there have been a number of different fires over the last couple of days going on, this one just being the largest of them. The police spokesman, Mickey Rosenfeld, said that 12 people have been arrested across Israel on suspicion of arson, and some of the other countries, leaders in the country, have raised the possibility that Arab assailants had intentionally set these fires ablaze.
And over to Richard.
The European Parliament voted to end Turkey's bid to become an EU member yesterday. It's just a symbolic vote. They have no actual power here, but it's clear that Turkey is not going to draw closer to the EU the way that they wanted. The bigger question now is, how is Turkey going to respond? They've been helping Europe out with its migrant crisis to a certain extent this year, but this kind of thing could change their minds, making the migrant situation in Europe much, much worse.
And now to Andrew.
A San Antonio police officer was shot to death in his squad car while riding a traffic ticket this Sunday. There have been actually 240 policemen attacked in ambush-style attacks so far this year, making this the highest year for ambush-style attacks on police officers since 2006.
All right, we'll go back to Jeremiah.
South Korea's foreign ministry said on Tuesday that South Korea's controversial military intelligence sharing agreement with Japan will see the two sides share a lot of really important military secrets with each other. A government spokesman said that it's just a technical agreement and cautioned critics against stretching the meaning of it. It has a lot of significance, especially when you consider how much animosity has remained between Japan and South Korea ever since World War II. Right now, their mutual fear of China and North Korea is trumping all of that.
All right, back to Brent.
More than 1,000 soldiers deployed by Iran to Syria to back the government's side in its civil war have been killed, an Iranian official declared this week, underlying Tehran's increasing presence on the front lines and the losses that it has incurred. It's a major increase from the reported death toll of just 4 months ago when they said they had lost around 400 of its soldiers. Since that time, 600 have been added to the list.
And back over to Richard.
German Chancellor Angela Merkel indicated she's not going to shy away from confronting Donald Trump this week. Earlier in the week, Mr. Trump said that he would pull America out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. I think he said that on Sunday. And Ms. Merkel said, "I will tell you honestly, I am not happy that the Trans-Pacific Agreement will now probably not become reality." So, again, not afraid of directly criticizing the U.S. president. Gives an indication of how the relationship is going to develop.
And we'll finish with Andrew.
The White House announced on Tuesday that President Obama will be commuting the sentence of 79 more prisoners. This means so far for his 8 years in office, he has commuted over 1,023 prison sentences, more than the previous 11 presidents combined.
I'm Joel Hilliker, and we're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Look us up online at thetrumpet.com, and we will give you a free subscription to our weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. Everything that we talk about on this program, we jam into this 12-page report each week, and you can receive it in your email inbox every Friday for nothing. Tell us what you think of the program by emailing us at letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal.
Good to be here.
Great to be with you.
Great to be here.
Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with the words of Albert Einstein. There are only two ways to live your life. One is as though nothing is a miracle. The other is as though everything is a miracle. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.